Texas's top lawyer in the crosshairs of his own colleagues as they accuse Attorney General Ken Paxton of bribery and other possible crimes. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A one-page letter signed by seven of the Attorney General's top aides asked for an investigation of the Texas Attorney General. We'll hear more about the complaint and how Paxton and other top Texas officials are responding. Also, the president and other top Republicans urging supporters to be poll watchers. Just who can become a poll watcher? What does that involve? And what are the limits to their activities? Also, the Hispanic Republican from Nixon to Trump, and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this fifth day of October 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your Monday's going well so far. This week is not off to a strong start for Texas's top lawyer. The Attorney General of Texas, as you may already know, has had a legal cloud of his own hanging over him since the summer of 2015. During his first four-year term as AG, Ken Paxton was arrested, put into the Collin County Jail, and released on a no-money bond for three felony counts involving private business deals which carry a maximum penalty of 99 years in prison. Remember? But he's managed to remain in office throughout his criminal case, which has been delayed by appeals and legal motions from his defense team. Now, Paxton has always maintained his innocence, claiming he was the target of conservative political opponents. But as of today, he faces what might be a more ominous threat to his position. The Austin American-Statesman and Austin TV station KVIEW reported over the weekend that top aides to the Texas Attorney General have asked federal law enforcement officials to investigate their own boss. They allege bribery, improper influence, abuse of office, and other potential crimes, quote, in his official capacity as the Attorney General of Texas, close quote. Now, here to untangle the latest accusations, Tony Plohetsky, a reporter for The Statesman and KVIEW, who brought this story to light. Tony, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me again.
It's my understanding you got a hold of a whistleblower complaint that was made last week to the HR department of the Attorney General's office. What did that complaint say?
Well, it essentially said, we believe we have evidence that our boss, the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, is committing crimes and calling on federal investigators to take this case up and to investigate Ken Paxton fully. As you mentioned, it's really striking. I mean, this is almost a mutiny by his top administrative aides. These are not low-level employees. These are essentially members of Ken Paxton's highest-ranking department. They are his inner circle. And so it was striking not only because of their ranks and their titles within the agency, but this is also them turning on their boss and saying, we believe the Attorney General has been carrying out a number of different possible crimes.
Is it clear what those crimes might be more specifically? I mean, these are pretty broad allegations.
What we have learned in the past day or so is that they relate to Ken Paxton's relationship and activities with an Austin-based financial investor by the name of Nate Paul. Nate Paul had his office raided by the FBI last year. He has never been charged with a crime, but there appears to be some sort of relationship between those two, and that is further evidenced by a text message that the seven high-ranking employees of the AG's office sent their boss last week. They said, we have made an outcry to law enforcement, and they named Nate Paul specifically and the relationship between Ken Paxton and Nate Paul. We're still learning, as you can imagine, this is sort of a rolling story, a breaking story. But what we know is that Ken Paxton appears to have hired a special prosecutor out of Houston, a fairly young attorney who specializes in defense work in Houston, to conduct an investigation about whether the FBI may have violated federal law on the raid of Nate Paul's home and businesses last year.
So Paul in his relationship with Paxton? Is Paul a campaign donor? And you know, he's a real estate financier.
He has been a campaign donor of Kim Paxton, but we are also, as you can imagine, trying to learn more about their relationship. I mean, these employees have said now publicly, essentially, in a public text message to their boss, a text message that has been made public, the relationship and activities. So, of course, we are trying to learn what exactly does that mean? What is the nature of their relationship? What have those activities been? And that is information that I hope we are able to learn more about today and in coming days.
Very interesting what Mr. Paxton had to say in a statement Saturday evening. You report that the Attorney General said that the complaint was done to impede an ongoing investigation into criminal wrongdoing by public officials, including employees of this office. And he goes on to say, making false claims is a very serious matter, and we plan to investigate this to the fullest extent of the law. What about the governor or the lieutenant governor? Have they weighed in yet?
They have. Essentially, what they have both said was almost the same thing, kind of almost a copy and paste sort of statement. And what they said in those statements is these allegations are very, very serious, but we are going to withhold further comment until we know exactly what is going on with the Attorney General. But what is striking about those statements is that neither one of them appear to be running to the defense of the Attorney General, at least right now.
Investigative reporter Tony Plohetsky is with the Austin American-Statesman and KVU Television. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Tony, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us again on The Standard.
Thank you so much.
From President Donald Trump to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, prominent members of the Republican Party, as well as others, have been suggesting that their supporters this election cycle go to the polls and watch very carefully for any suspicious voting activity. But a person can't just walk up to a polling location during early voting or on election day and declare themselves a poll watcher. Here in Texas, there are some official steps you have to take. Matt Largie has been looking into that. He's projects editor at our home station, KUT in Austin. Matt, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what a poll watcher is supposed to do and perhaps what they are not allowed to do.
All right, so a poll watcher can watch, and that's essentially all they can do. They're at a polling place to keep an eye out for violations of the election code. They're not there to intervene. They're not there to enforce the law. They are only there to keep an eye out. And so if they see a violation of the election law, they can report that to the election judge that's on site there at a polling place, or the election clerk who will bring it to the judge. But that's sort of where their authority ends. They can report those things, but again, they cannot enforce them.
Is it possible, though, forgive me for interrupting, that if you're a voter, you go into the voting booth and the poll watcher objects to something, say, that you're wearing or who knows what? Is it possible you could be denied the opportunity to vote because a poll watcher says he or she saw you do something wrong?
It's certainly possible. If you go to a polling place wearing a shirt or something that supports a candidacy, technically that's electioneering, and a poll watcher could call that as a violation of the election code. Of course, the election judge could also do that, or the clerk who's checking you in will also likely see that and ask you to go change your shirt.
You mean a poll watcher has the power to stop someone from actually casting a ballot, or is that placed on the election official other than the poll watcher?
That is strictly up to the election officials. The election judge and the election clerk who's working that polling site, they are the authorities there. The poll watcher can only report things that they see, not enforce the law.
What do you have to do? What steps do you have to take if you want to be a poll watcher? I think some listeners may be concerned that sort of rookie poll watchers will just show up at the polls and declare themselves poll watchers.
Well, first of all, you've got to be a registered voter in the territory where the election is happening, either your city or your county or your school district. And then there are some people who are not allowed to be poll watchers. If you're a candidate for office, you can't be a poll watcher. if you're already in elective office, you can't be a poll watcher. So you have to meet some criteria. And then you've got to be appointed specifically by one of three groups, and that's either a candidate, a political party, or the opponents or proponents of a ballot measure. And they've got to give you an official letter that says you've been appointed, that includes some pretty basic information about the group that's appointed you and about you, the poll watcher.
If you don't have that letter, are you allowed to hang around a precinct to watch the polls?
No. There is a state law that bans loitering within 100 feet of the entrance to a polling place. So I suppose you could hang out outside that 100-foot barrier, that 100-foot radius. But no, you can't loiter at the polls if you're not an official poll watcher.
A lot of the reasoning, as I understand it, from why some politicians are bringing up poll watchers is because of allegations, especially from some prominent Republicans, that there could be some kind of voter fraud. Is there concern about the intimidation of people going to the polls this year?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that around the country, actually. I mean, after the president called for people to go and watch the polls, a lot of voting rights groups have said, wait a minute, this sounds a lot like voter intimidation. And so, you know, voters should know that they have a right to not be intimidated at the polls. It's, you know, a violation of federal law to intimidate voters at the polls. If they see anything like that, or if they experience that, they should report it to the election judge or to the official election workers that are working that polling place.
Matt Largy is projects editor at our home station, KUT in Austin. Matt, thanks for the clarification. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday. Welcome to Monday, Wells.
Welcome to Monday as well, David. Well, that bombshell news in Texas politics has folks talking. Seven top aides for Texas AG Ken Paxton accusing their boss of bribery and saying they need the FBI to investigate. Pointing to the previous allegations against Paxton and the indictment hanging over his head, Kimberly Palomo writes, "I'm not surprised, though I wish I could say I am." And via Twitter, John E.D. says, "Of all the things being indicted and arrested on three felonies would disqualify you for, I would think being attorney general would be towards the top of the list. I guess those jury duty forms are being overly dramatic. Indeed, Texas law prohibits folks under indictment from serving on a jury." Of course, we can't talk about the news and what's happening on social media without talking about this: President Trump's hospitalization at Walter Reed, that trip in the motorcade, and more. I'll be back with reactions later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. What's on your news radar on this start of the week? Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice, and wouldn't you know it, Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. About a third of Texans identify as evangelical Protestants. That's a group President Donald Trump is counting on to vote for him in November, especially evangelical women in the suburbs. But as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider discovered in talking with some of those voters, not all are on board with the political gospel, according to Donald Trump.
Ever since she turned 18, Sarah Damoff has voted her faith. She considered herself a single-issue voter on abortion and supported Republicans. When the Dallas resident couldn't bring herself to vote for Trump in 2016, she wound up voting for a third party instead. After Trump won, she swore she wouldn't do that in 2020.
But here I am again, certain that I do not want to see a second term with Trump, but also not really a fan of the Biden-Harris candidacy.
For decades, most evangelicals have voted Republican, absorbing the lesson from their communities that the Democratic Party is hostile to their beliefs. But more evangelicals, especially younger women in their 20s and 30s, are wrestling with their vote and their faith this presidential election. For some of his supporters, it seems Trump's policies count more than his character. Here's Kristen Cobb of Northwest Houston.
Trump has protected the unborn. He appointed conservative judges to the judiciary. He supported Israel. And he advocates for religious freedom. And that is something that something that I believe that, you know, the Word of God tells us that we should be supporting.
And if Trump isn't a perfect vessel, well, no human being is perfect. Melissa Conway of Friendswood says she has personally witnessed Trump growing in his Christian walk.
Is President Trump personally and through his social media use and his colorful language a work in progress based upon who Christ is in comparison? Yes, he is. But so am I as a believer.
For many evangelicals, therefore, the choice between Trump and Biden is no choice at all. Here's Kristen Cobb again.
Many of us believe this is actually a fight between good and evil.
But not all evangelicals see Trump as advancing the Word of God. Tess Clark of Dallas was a lifelong Republican. She did not vote in 2016 because she couldn't support Trump, but also didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton because of abortion. Clark says the Bible urges people to care for the foreigner, the stranger, the poor, and that matters just as much as Trump's stance on abortion.
You know, I kept seeing this over and over again and thinking, man, how could I vote for the current administration when all I see them doing is pushing those specific people and those specific categories further into the margins?
This time, Clark says she's voting for Biden. In fact, there may be a generational dispute developing among evangelicals. Stephanie Martin, a professor at Southern Methodist University, calls this trend the rot in the basement of the Republican Party.
If just, 10% or 15% of younger evangelicals get in the habit of voting for Democrats, that would be ruinous to the Republican Party going forward, because it required 80%, 78% of evangelicals to get Donald Trump elected.
But turning your back on a party tied to your faith isn't easy. That's what Tess Clark learned when she voted for Beto O'Rourke for the Senate in 2018.
I've been called by people that I personally know a baby killer. I've been told I can't be a Christian and vote for Joe Biden.
Clark says it's been hard, but she believes if the gospel isn't good news for the poor and the marginalized, then it's not the gospel. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
It's the Texas Standard. The Dallas Morning News reported last week that delinquencies are soaring for federally backed home loans in Texas. That would be consistent with the narrative we've heard since the start of the pandemic that layoffs and furloughs have Texans tightening their belts, and in some cases to the point of pain. But at the same time, Texas has become one of the hottest housing markets in the nation. With demand regularly exceeding supply, prices going up in many parts of Texas, and many experts predicting that home sales this fall in the Lone Star State will remain strong as we move through the fall. What gives? Luis Torres is a research economist at Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center in the Mays School of Business. Luis, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing a lot about how housing demand is so high and supply is limited. In some parts of Texas, I was reading in North Texas, it's been hard to keep up with demand. What's going on?
So, you know, think about it. The people who were more affected because of the COVID-19 pandemic were basically low-skill, low-wage earners. They work in the retail industry sector. So they're more renters than actually buyers. People who actually can buy a house can actually work from home. And that market wasn't as affected as, you say, the rental market. And before COVID-19, the housing market was expected to have a great year in 2020. So if you add also the low interest rates right now, so that's another pro for the housing market.
So the fact that we're seeing this increase in delinquencies, should that be a warning sign?
It should be. Okay, so one of the things we saw different than in past recessions was that normally what happens, first of all, you see income levels fall, right? When you have a recession, first thing happens, income level falls. Why? Because you lose your job, right? But what happened with the CARES Act and the federal policies, actually income, personal income actually went up. And also, don't forget the programs, the forbearance program that helps a lot of people not to enter into delinquency rates or to enter in foreclosures. The latest data from the Mortgage Bankers Association, it tells you about 3.6 million homeowners are in forbearance. So what's going to happen when the forbearance ends? Are they going to be able to make their payments? Do they have a job? Well, we don't know, right? How many people are going to be able to make those payments, mortgage payments, when the forbearance ends?
We don't know, but a lot of this, when we're talking about loan delinquencies, that sounds a lot like what we were looking at in 2007, when we were seeing loan delinquencies spike. Should we be concerned about a bubble forming right now?
No, this is different. You know, the recession was started because of a health crisis, right? And we went into an economic coma by decision, right? And comparing to the 2008, 2009 Great Recession, don't forget we had a housing bubble form, right? Here, the housing market was doing exceptionally well before that. As I mentioned to you earlier, we were expecting a great year in 2020 for the housing market. Think about it, like 30%, 34% of the home sales are in a price range between $200,000 to $300,000. And the months of inventory are around 2 months of inventory. So home builders were actually trying to catch up with that.
If in fact, though, we can't find, say, a vaccine for the coronavirus, this period of recession extends, doing the math, at least as I see it, there is the possibility that as income levels drop because there's no more COVID-19 support, for example, we could nonetheless see a crash in the market, right?
So there could be a negative effect, right? You can especially see those people who right now are purchasing homes that were less affected, that work in technology or the type of industry that allows them to work from home.
They could take a big hit.
Exactly. Later on, if the pandemic continues, then that will definitely spread, right, to other sectors in the economy. The future depends on how well we treat the pandemic. It depends on health outcomes.
Luis Torres is a research economist at Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center in the Mays School of Business. Professor, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Oh, you're welcome, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A top infectious disease expert from Texas says President Trump should stay in the hospital until at least midweek due to his COVID-19 diagnosis. Dr. Peter Hotez, dean of Baylor College of Medicine, cites high risk factors, including Trump's age, weight, and low blood oxygen levels reported over the weekend.
He's getting multiple experimental treatments, which have, in some cases, have rarely been used in combination together. He is having those drops in oxygen. I don't see the hurry in getting him out of Walter Reed.
Hotez spoke with ABC 13 in Houston Sunday. The president may be discharged later today. It's the last day for Texans to register to vote in the November general election. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Texans can get an application at votetexas.gov. After filling out the application, they'll then have two options. Either drop off the voter registration form at their county registrar's office or mail it in. And all mailed-in applications must be postmarked by today. As of last month, more than 16.6 million Texans have registered to vote, a new state record.
Sasha Cordner reporting. A Northeast Texas police officer is on administrative leave after fatally shooting a black man in Wolf City, about 70 miles outside of Dallas. KETR's Mark Haslett reports the Texas Rangers are investigating.
The Wolf City police officer, who officials have not yet identified, shot Jonathan Price 3 times on Saturday night. His family members say Price was trying to break up an altercation at a gas station convenience store between another man and a woman. An officer responded to a report of the disturbance and fired at Price. No other injuries were reported. A vigil honoring Price, who was well known in the community, is scheduled for 6:30 this evening in Wolf City. I'm Mark Haslett in Commerce.
Megan Thee Stallion used her appearance on Saturday Night Live's season premiere to criticize Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron after only one officer involved in the fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor was indicted. The Houston rapper spoke to the audience while performing her hit song, Savage.
We need to protect our black women and love our black women. Because at the end of the day, we need our black women.
Megan also said black men need to be protected. Her message on SNL comes months after she herself experienced gun violence. Canadian rapper Tory Lanez allegedly fired several shots at Megan in July, injuring her feet. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. President Trump is being treated for COVID-19 at Walter Reed Hospital. The data that we have about COVID suggests odds are good the president will come through this just fine. History, of course, tells us that there are no sure things. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie says this isn't the first time an American president has become infected with a novel virus that sickened the world.
In April 1919, President Woodrow Wilson was in Paris negotiating the future of Europe following World War I when something went wrong.
Well, Wilson got very sick. You know, his doctor was with him, the White House physician, Cary Grayson. Grayson himself said it was one of the worst nights of his life trying to see Wilson through the night.
John Barry is a professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest plague in history. It chronicles the 1918 pandemic. Barry says the president got so sick so suddenly that Grayson thought he might have been poisoned. But it became clear fairly quickly that Wilson had become one of the planet's 500 million people infected with the H1N1 flu virus that ultimately killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide. And Wilson was quite sick.
Wilson, you know, was in bed for about 5 days. Both the British and French prime ministers came to his room and negotiated.
Barry says the president suffered from extreme fatigue, a high fever, disabling coughing fits, and shortness of breath, as well as changes in behavior. He seemed disoriented and even paranoid. And no one outside of Wilson's immediate circle knew the president had the flu.
No, Grayson first tried to keep Wilson's condition secret. When it leaked out, then he said Wilson had a bad cold.
Now, a century later, another president is infected with another virus during a pandemic. This time, though, we know about it. And we know much more about COVID-19 than any doctor knew about H1N1 back in 1918 or 1919. First, something reassuring we know. Most people who are infected with the COVID virus, including those in their 70s like the president, who's 74, survive.
That's right.
Dr. Jason Bowling is an expert in infectious diseases at UT Health San Antonio.
Most people that are 74 and older will still survive, particularly now we've had advances in what care we can give people compared to the beginning of the pandemic when we had less treatments and we didn't fully understand what we could use.
But once you're older than 65, your risk of severe disease does increase dramatically, according to the Centers for Disease Control. CDC says those between the ages of 65 and 74 face a 5 times greater risk of hospitalization and a 90 times greater risk of dying from COVID-19 compared to those between the ages of 18 and 29. And President Trump has a couple of other known risk factors. One, he's overweight. CDC says people who are obese are 3 times more likely to end up in the hospital with COVID-19, and he's a man.
In some studies, there's some data that suggests that being male, for reasons that aren't fully understood, can put you at higher risk as well.
Bowling says that can all add up.
There's some data that shows the more risk factors you have, the higher your risk for having more severe illness. It's not clear if they're additive or what degree, but definitely having more risk factors puts you at higher risk of more severe illness, the need for hospitalization, ventilation, those kind of things.
Knowing all that, and that symptoms of this disease can escalate quickly, Bowling says the hospital is probably the best place for the president of the United States right now.
Certainly, you know, being in the hospital setting would allow for more intensive monitoring, constant monitoring of heart rate, blood pressure, oxygen saturations. You can draw labs and have those analyzed.
And you can administer experimental COVID medicines that are only given in the hospital right now, like remdesivir. President Trump received an experimental antibody treatment before going to the hospital.
And basically what you're doing with that is you're trying to use antibodies early on to prevent the virus from being able to increase in numbers and cause more severe illness.
While there's no reason to believe that Trump won't make a full recovery from this virus, history reminds us that Wilson wasn't so lucky. Author John Barry says some close to Wilson reported the president never really recovered.
After his illness, he just couldn't process information. He couldn't make a decision. He could be pushed around. And I think it's reasonable to think that the influenza attack in early April contributed to it, may have caused Wilson's stroke that came several months later.
The full impact of that stroke on the president's ability to lead was also obscured from everyone outside of Wilson's immediate circle. Many historians agree that for the rest of his term, which ended in 1921, his wife, Edith, secretly ran the country. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Here in Texas, we often hear that Texas Hispanics will soon become the majority of the population in the state. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean this translates into a large voting population of Democrats turning Texas blue, though that has certainly been part of the popular narrative. Sure, it can be said that Hispanics tend to vote more Democrat. Statistics tell us that. But it's the understanding of the political identity of the Hispanic Republican that could arguably be key to understanding the future of politics in Texas. Joining us now is Geraldo Cadava. He is associate professor of Northwestern University and author of the book, The Hispanic Republican, The Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to us a little bit more about Hispanic voters. They are not monolithic, of course, but there is this notion that some voters have, that Hispanic voters can't or shouldn't be Republican. Is this a more recent idea, notion, or has it been going around for some time now?
Well, I think the notion that Hispanics are quote-unquote naturally liberal has been around for a long time, but the truth is, since Richard Nixon's re-election in 1972, about a third, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more, about a third of Latinos have voted for the Republican Party. I think it has become even more unlikely or seemingly unlikely during the Trump years, but it's still the truth that about 30% of Latinos vote for Republicans.
Where is it that Hispanic voters tend to find affinity with the Republican Party?
Well, both in terms of geography and issues. I think, you know, one misconception is that Latino conservatives are, you know, in a little slice of South Florida and they care mostly about Cuban politics and things like that. But the movement, the Hispanic Republican movement, is truly much more diverse than that. And you can find Mexican Americans in Texas, Arizona, California, Puerto Ricans in New York and Florida who are also Republicans. In terms of the issues they care about, I think, you know, for a long time, it's been understood that issues like religious freedom or even kind of patriotism, and, you know, it's important to keep in mind that Latinos serve in the military, the border patrol and police officers, anti-communism in Latin America, school choice, religious freedom, all of these things are issues that draw Latinos into the Republican Party.
When you say religious freedom, are you referring more specifically to the high number of Catholics, for example, from Mexico who come to the United States and maybe have more traditional values when it comes to issues such as abortion or something mm-hmm. different? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's part of it. But I do think also that that's the other misconception about Latino Republicans, that they're either Cuban exiles or Catholics or both. So I think Catholicism, anti-abortion views, that's an important part of what I mean by religious freedom. But I'm also thinking about evangelical Christians and what we often refer to as the separation between church and state. A lot of them send their children to charter schools that have religious affiliations as evangelical Christians. And so they interpret a lot of what they see in the world in terms of law and politics through scripture. And so I think it's really all of those things.
In Texas, where the Hispanic population will soon be the majority of the state, do you see Republican leaders as seeing and somehow seizing the opportunity to keep Texas in Republican control by courting more of the Hispanic vote as you describe it? I mean, this wouldn't be a huge leap after all, as polling trends have shown, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think Republican leaders see Hispanic Republicans as, in many ways, representing the future of the Republican Party in Texas. And that's been true for a long time. I think John Tower, a senator from Texas, was really important to bringing Hispanics into the Republican Party, both statewide and nationally. More recently, you have former Governor George W. Bush, and now you have Governor Greg Abbott, who is, you know, endorsing some Hispanic Republicans for the Texas State House and U.S. Congress. So I think, you know, yes, demographic change is a reality, and I think Republicans know that as well as anyone else. And I think Hispanic Republicans in Texas are key. And if anything, you know, yes, I know there's a conversation about Texas purpling, becoming, you know, a true two-party state because of Latino population growth. And that's a possibility, but it's also just as much a possibility that Hispanic Republicans will be a kind of bulwark for the Republican Party in Texas.
Republicans often talk about expanding the tent and bringing in more people from different voting blocks, including what you describe as the Hispanic electorate. And I'm curious now how you grow that tent if an entire block of potential voters feel a certain degree of hostility directed at people of color, for example. I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I think, you know, one that requires the most explaining, just because in this moment of the Republican Party, it really seems like they have moved hard to the right on immigration and border security. But, you know, even if the percentage of Latinos to whom those ideas appeal is very small, I don't think that border security and, you know, policies that would be called anti-immigrant policies and Hispanic Republican identity are mutually exclusive. I mean, I've been talking with some candidates for office in the Rio Grande Valley, like Monica de la Cruz, for example. And a lot of her platform is based on border security and the idea that for the whole time that she's lived in the Rio Grande Valley, she's witnessed this surge in crimes committed by Mexican immigrants, things like that. So I think the idea that border security is an important part of the Republican Party's platform makes a lot of sense to some Mexican Americans. I mean, there's also the Border Hispanics for Trump group running out of El Paso. And again, I mean, it's a small percentage of Latinos to whom border security and Trump's tough immigration stances appeal, but it is there. And it's, I think, sincere.
What lessons do you think there might be to be taken from the history of the Hispanic voting bloc as we look to the future of this upcoming election? How do you see that playing out?
Well, you know, I think the main thing is that both parties, for a long period of time, have taken Latinos for granted in one way or another. I think, you know, Reagan famously said that Latinos are Republicans who just don't know it yet. And Democrats have also felt that Latinos are natural Democrats. And I think that considering Latinos to be naturally anything in a partisan sense is a way of taking them for granted, because it doesn't recognize that they are serious political actors with true, real, sincere ideas that are deeply held. And I think the important thing is that candidates from both parties need to listen to Latinos when they tell them what they care about and take them seriously and go fight for every one of their votes. I mean, for the Republicans in particular, I would say that just because the Republican Party has won 30% of the Latino vote pretty consistently for the past 50 years, it does not mean that they are destined to win 30% of their vote going forward. And I think when Latinos represent a ever-growing slice of the American electorate and the American population, winning 30% of their vote isn't going to be a recipe for success for much longer. So I think they're going to have to figure out ways to expand their support among Latinos if they want to remain relevant well into the future.
Geraldo Cadava is an associate professor at Northwestern University and author of a provocative new book, The Hispanic Republic and the Shaping of an American Political Identity from Nixon to Trump. Professor, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm really grateful that you had me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For decades, the U.S. has searched for a long-term home for its nuclear waste. A plan to store it at Yucca Mountain in Nevada has been stalled for years with no clear alternative. So now federal energy officials are looking for a temporary place to store radioactive material, although in this case, temporary could mean up to 60 years. One of the sites in the running is Andrews, a West Texas oil field community about 35 miles north of Odessa. A company called Interim Storage Partners wants to store nuclear waste there, but it has some powerful opponents, including Governor Greg Abbott. Last week, the governor sent a letter to President Trump asking him not to send the waste to Texas. To tell us more, we bring in Travis Bubenik. He is a reporter for Courthouse News based in West Texas. Welcome back to The Standard, Travis.
Hey, good to be here.
So this is the first time the governor has actually weighed in publicly on this issue, to my knowledge. Why is he against storing this waste in West Texas?
Well, the reasons that he cites in this letter have to do with safety concerns, which others have certainly raised about this plan. But by and large, it's about threats, possible threats to the oil and gas industry. I mean, you're talking about bringing, you know, this highly radioactive waste from around the country to kind of the heart of the Permian Basin oil field, obviously the nation's largest and, you know, until the pandemic hit, really booming oil field. And Abbott cites all kind of possible threats to, you know, not just that sector of the Texas economy, but impacts to the nation's national security if somehow an accident happened and our energy supply became disrupted.
What is his fear that the underground supply could become contaminated, that workers could be injured by this storage process? What is he specific about what his concerns are in that regard?
There's not a whole lot of specifics that are mentioned in the letter that he mentioned. I mean, again, a lot of it has to do with just the possible economic ramifications of a nuclear waste accident in the Permian Basin oil field. I mean, he also does cite things like, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, we don't want to let the Permian Basin oil field become a target for bad actors, for terrorism, for anything like that with this stockpile of nuclear waste out there. But it's not super nitty gritty. Again, it's mostly just, here's an important part of our economy mm-hmm. and national security, and we don't want to bring any unnecessary risks to it.
What are people who live in that part of Texas saying about this project? It was my understanding that some folks around Andrews saw a kind of economic benefit that they might get out of having this waste site there in Andrews.
Yeah, I mean, the Andrews County commissioners, you know, have embraced the project for years. We have to remember that there is an existing nuclear waste site there on the Texas-New Mexico border in that county. Certainly, some in the community have welcomed it. It's, you know, it contributes to the tax base. But this plan to bring, again, way more highly radioactive waste to West Texas has been opposed by a variety of folks. I mean, you know, just some locals in the region. You also have ranching and oil communities and landowners who are not too sure about this. I mean, you know, part of the effort that seems to have got Abbott's attention is this coalition of oil and gas groups and landowners and ranching types that got together and said, you know, we're worried about what this could do to our land, to the value of mm-hmm. basically our oil royalties, you know, and that kind of thing.
But, of course, the regulatory agency in charge here is the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. If officials at the federal level choose to send this waste to Texas, is there anything the state can do to stop it?
Good question. I guess the answer is we'll see. I mean, I think the most impactful thing that a state can do is just push back politically. I mean, Nevada didn't want this stuff, and it didn't go to Nevada. And now you've got New Mexico's governor, Texas's governor saying, we don't want it. I think you can't underestimate the political pushback and what that can do. I mean, just in February, President Trump tweeted out that he had heard the opposition from Nevadans and seemed to kind of backtrack on his plans to maybe rethink sending it to Nevada. So now that's off the table, seemingly. But yeah, I mean, it's a federal decision, long ways down the road, as it should say. Who knows what the state can actually do, but I think the political pushback is not something to take for granted.
Travis Bubenik is a reporter for Courthouse News based in West Texas. Travis, we'll link to your latest over at texasstandard.org. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what listeners are talking about statewide. He's our social media editor. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Wild weekend for the news as reflected on social media, with President Trump being escorted to Walter Reed Hospital by helicopter, Marine One, following a positive diagnosis for the coronavirus. And honestly, where to even start with everything we saw over the weekend, conflicting timelines, information from doctors. And notably on Sunday, after promising a surprise for supporters outside the hospital in a video the president posted to Twitter, he actually took a trip in his motorcade past those supporters, him wearing a mask, a non-medical grade mask, and being in the same contained vehicle, windows up, with his Secret Service members masked up as well. Obviously, has generated a lot of conversation on social media, and including the Texas Standard Twitter and Facebook pages. Via Twitter, Ashley Stewart calls it infuriating. She says, if he actually has the virus, he would be quarantined at the hospital. He's making our lives a chaotic reality show, and I can't wait to vote him out, in her words. Many other people just pointing out the sort of irresponsibility they see there. And a little bit of breaking news I see at this time. Yet another member of the White House, of the Trump White House, Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, just in the previous few minutes announcing that she has tested positive for coronavirus. Because that was another thing we saw over the weekend, the sort of domino effect of aide after top aide sort of coming, announcing a positive diagnosis. So obviously concerning as well, because we've seen lots of videos, photos of her interacting with members of the press, no mask on either. So obviously a developing story that's continuing to rock D.C. and the rest of the nation.
Yeah, there have been some conversation over the weekend in the New York Times about a super spreader event that was held at the White House, and a lot of senators and others, journalists in Washington, are very concerned about their health right now.
Decidedly so. And closer to home, following up on that story at the top of the show, a little bit of breaking news there in the concerns brought by top lieutenants of a Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, saying that he is guilty of instances including bribery, undue influence, and the like. No one has called for his resignation until now. No prominent Republican, that is. But now we have Representative Chip Roy running for re-election to the House of Representatives this November against one Wendy Davis. He is now calling on Ken Paxton to resign, saying that these allegations of bribery, abuse of office, and other charges levied against him are more than troubling on the merits. And then goes on to say that he needs to step down because of the trust that he has in those seven senior leaders of the Attorney General's office. And it really is impossible to overstate the sort of tight-knit nature. It's like all these people in the same conservative Christian legal circles. So really, it's devastating to see those seven people come out against their boss, essentially, David.
Certainly for Attorney General Paxton. And it's a story we continue to track here on The Standard. You can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Until tomorrow, when we're back on the big broadcast, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.